Returning to our show for this segment is Dr. Andy Jones of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Welcome back, Dr. Andy.
Thank you very much. I think I'll just remind everyone that my show can be heard Wednesday afternoons at the same time as Dr. Doug's show, and that we talk about poetry and technology every week. I invite you all to tune in.
Yes, you certainly all should tune in. You should have your dial tuned to 90.3 FM throughout the day, and particularly at 5 o'clock.
If you want interesting music and hard-hitting and challenging and engaging public affairs programming, really you should just glue your dial to 90.3 FM and leave it there.
Indeed you should. Now, a couple weeks back on this program, we were talking about Philo T. Farnsworth, the father, or certainly one of the fathers, and you could argue the father, of electronic television. And that was interesting talk about what happened to poor Philo. We like to think of him as one of the last of the lone inventors.
He was unheralded, unappreciated in his lifetime. And hopefully, with a couple books that have come out and shows like the one you did a couple weeks ago, people will begin to realize his importance, kind of rediscover what he did for all of us insofar as being the first inventor, American inventor, of television as we know it.
Yeah. But unfortunately, if you listen to the show, you know that he came up second when it came to battling with that other great stereotype of American life, the lawyer. the battery of lawyers, right. The corporation lawyer.
The battery of lawyers and also the corporate boss who, almost like Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane, he would stop at nothing at crushing his enemies, even when they had come across their inventions before he had bought them from others.
There's a great tradition, I think, in America of becoming a philanthropist and giving away a lot of money to help people after you've crushed all your opponents and ground them into the dirt. Going back to J.D. Rockefeller and a lot of other people.
A lot of the great names after whom libraries and universities are named.
Sad but true.
You know, we can be thankful to them now. And I guess they really have bought their legacy, and it worked, or gave away their legacy, you know, in their waning years, yeah. Money that they had stolen from hardworking Americans for their entire lives.
But I thought we would talk about television, not just, you know, we talked about Farnsworth, but, you know, television is a very big subject. I mean, who among us, it's a rare person indeed that hasn't spent an awful lot of time in front of the boob tube. I mean, I know when I was a little kid, I mean, nobody watched more television than I did. Of course, I'm old enough to have gotten in when television actually, there was some programming pitched at people with IQs above, you know, 94. So it was, as a kid, a great learning tool, because there's so much you were seeing that was going on.
If you're talking about the 1950s, and I think you are, then certainly that was a time when... It was a time when, you know, certainly when we think about the Eisenhower years, we think about how, you know, it's a time period that Allen Ginsberg reflects upon in his poem Howl, where he tries to reflect, as Jack Kerouac did, kind of the seamy underbelly of the Eisenhower America. But when you look at the sort of interesting things that people were doing with theater, with television, where they had to kind of be aware of the restrictions, of the censors, of the
right.
expectations.
Right.
And therefore, they couldn't just let it all hang out. They had to challenge themselves to come up with interesting scripts and to offer more subtle commentary yeah. on what was going on in the country.
It's interesting to think of television and radio before it as what a revolution it's created and what a potential for good it could have done in terms of educating people. But I think it was clear from the late 1920s with radio that people didn't really much want to be educated. They wanted to be entertained, and they put together a formula. Sarnoff did it at RCA, and then over at CBS, William Paley stole away a lot of Sarnoff's stars by paying them more money, and then there
right.
was a big battle between NBC and CBS. But it became an entertainment medium in the 30s, a very successful one. And when television got off the ground, that's the same direction it went.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those radio stars moved over to television. You can think about Jack Benny.
Yes.
Or Burns and Allen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was watching an old Burns and Allen show, obviously an old one a couple years ago. And at one point, George Burns pretends to, well, he does like walk over to his neighbor's house, and it was across this huge like sound stage. And just before he gets to the door, he looks at us and he says, "You can see why this would take much less time on radio." And so basically what he's saying is he's drawing attention to the ridiculousness of television,
yes,
but also reminding us all these television dramas and comedies were kind of transported,
yeah,
over to this new medium. And in some ways, not a lot was changed, except
right,
that the performers had to actually memorize their lines rather than carrying around scripts,
right,
as they did in the 20s and 30s.
And we just had the passing, we should take a moment to mention, too, of basically the king of television in the earliest days, Milton Berle, who,
yeah,
passed away this year. And Berle was, again, like Amos and Andy before him in the 20s, apparently in the late 40s when the Texaco Star Theater came on the air, I mean, nobody was out to dinner.
Right.
I mean, theaters were dark. I mean, people were sitting at home watching this new craze of television in a way we've never seen since.
And when you look at those old tapes, you can see why, that a lot of the humor is sometimes a little risque.
Mm-hmm.
It's always visual. It's always funny, and it still gets us today.
And what gets me today still is the fact that you go on Nick at Night and you look at, and this is really sad, but if you look at the old I Love Lucy's,
yeah,
great scripts. I mean, very funny shows. I mean, they're still doing I Love Lucy. It's the same shtick they're doing, you know, 50 years later in situation comedies. But the originals were so much better.
Absolutely.
And by the 1960s, when I can remember this very well, television went south. I mean, television in the 50s, it was still pretty highbrow. There were a lot of people that, you know, only TV sets were expensive and only more wealthy people could afford them. And so it wasn't quite the mass market that it became in the 60s when TV kept selling and selling and selling. And pretty soon everyone had a television. And I think it was a man, Newton Minow, who's head of like was the FCC under Kennedy,
uh-huh,
referred to TV as a vast wasteland. Meanwhile, a man over at CBS, James Aubrey, realizes that, you know, Newton Minow's not watching. We don't care what he thinks.
Right.
And proceeds to produce Gomer Pyle, USMC, The Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres, Petticoat Junction, dumbs down television, and makes a fortune because the ratings go through the ceiling. This is what America wants to watch.
And that's what I, you know, was left on TV for me as a kid watching in the 70s, where all of this stuff was in syndication. And I was just, you know, watching the worst of the worst from the 1960s. It sounds like I didn't quite watch as much television as you did, even though my dad is a movie and entertainment critic on the local CBS affiliate in Washington, D.C. He was on TV all the time. But almost because of that, my parents kind of kicked me out of the house and said, you know, go find some friends and play with them.
Yeah.
Stop sitting in the living room all day.
Yeah, much as Philo Farnsworth wouldn't let his kids watch television because he thought it was just a wasteland.
Yeah, and to a great extent, you know, he was right. At least in my era, yeah.
Let's back into that story. Your dad was actually part of that early era of television. Let's talk about that a moment.
All right. My dad went to Antioch College in the 1950s, and one of the requirements there is that the students spend at least one equivalent of our academic quarters a year out working an internship in whatever field interested them. And my dad was a drama and theater major. He was interested in television. Rod Serling.
What year was this?
These were the early 50s.
Probably 51, maybe. 51.
When I asked my dad this question recently, he said, "Now, son, if we start talking about years, you'll soon find out that my early history is written on the walls of caves," meaning that, you know, we're going way back here. But yeah, this is the early 50s. I think it was like 51 or 52. My dad got an internship in an Ohio TV station, I think it was in Cincinnati, where he had a show called something like Captain Davy's Locker.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, Davy Jones, had a kids show where he was working with puppets. He was trying to put into practice many of these dramatic principles that he was learning at the same highbrow uh-huh. school that had produced Rod Serling. And he was entertaining kids on live television for an hour a day.
He's going from Shakespeare to puppets.
Exactly. But think about it. It's almost like a Farnsworth story that here he is as like a 20-year-old and he's the host of his own TV show, you know, watched by kids throughout Ohio. And
I can't
imagine. Of course, there's no footage of any of this, but I do remember going through some old stills with my dad in the 70s, and I'm sure these exist somewhere, of my dad with like zany kind of bozo hair with, you know, having an intellectual conversation with a puppet who was next to him. My dad was dressed in a 3-piece suit because he was trying to look older than he was. And somehow he's able to pull that off for an entire academic quarter.
So many of our directors in the golden era of movies, most recent one in the 70s, came right out of the fact that in these days, they were doing live television. Right. And people like Rod Serling, I guess, doing Requiem for a Heavyweight, you know, later became a movie. And Marty, I guess, was originally the Oscar winner in 1955, was first presented on live television with, I think, Rod Steiger playing the role that was later Ernest Borgnine.
So. Yeah, and I could, I mean, at least I could tell that that was the tradition that my father came out of, because he really thrived on those segments when, after reviewing a film, the director would give that universal sign of kind of draw this out a little bit. We've got 2 minutes to kill before the end of the program. Mm-hmm. And so my dad would have to engage with the anchor. You know, we're talking about Gordon Peterson, Max Robinson in Washington, D.C. in the 70s. Engage with them about whatever it was they could come up with. And usually they want to talk about the movie or play that he just saw. Mm-hmm. And my dad just thrived when, giving kind of mini lectures on dramatic or television principles. And I just loved it, but I could tell that the anchors were much less comfortable with this kind of instant performance that was required out of all of them. And we can see that now today when, you know, our on-air personalities, especially, say, local TV folks, have to actually have a conversation with one another about the news or the weather or, you know, the segue over to traffic. It's just so awkward. I think we need some more performers.
I would think so. Before the show, we were talking about this, and you mentioned your dad actually crossed paths with the immortal Rod Serling.
He did. My dad wanted to go to a college where he could continue as a performer. Now, for him in the 40s, late 30s and the 40s, that really meant his performances as a magician. He did magic acts throughout Indiana, and my grandfather would drive him like up to Michigan and over to Kansas and all these different places so my dad could do his magic act. And he wanted to continue. He's trying to find a place nearby where he could go to school. And somehow he wrote Rod Serling. And Serling said, yeah, it looks like you have some talent. You should go to Antioch College, where I went. And Serling had graduated a few years before.
Well, where is Antioch?
Antioch is in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Okay.
So it's just about 2 hours from nowhere in the middle of the country. And it turns out, as an aside, that my wife went to Antioch, and she and I met in London, of all places. So obviously there was something fated in there. But so as a result, my dad went off to Antioch. And it was seen as a hotbed of liberalism. And my grandfather was actually called into the office one day. He worked in a factory and told that either he had to pull my dad out of Antioch because of concerns about communist teachings that were going on there, at least according to the conservative business owners in Winchester, Indiana, or my grandfather would lose his job. My grandfather said, fire me then, and called his bluff and didn't get fired.
Wow.
But it was a difficult time for people who were interested in the arts and wanted to, as Rod Serling did, give kind of communicate messages beyond merely just entertaining the listening and viewing public.
There was a great segment on NPR here recently, and we also like to listen to Capital Public Radio, and we're not listening to KDVS. And they did a wonderful segment on early television and mentioned in Serling and how he, in desperation in the 50s, once this effort to censor came really down full force with, you know, the whole idea of, you know, everyone in the liberal arts must be a commie. And,
right.
And besides that, we control, you know, the content. So we're going to make sure that, like, for example, on the Leave It to Beaver, he wouldn't drink milk because they weren't sure if they were going to sell it to a soft drink manufacturer of the show to be a sponsor. So he would take, I like the usual junk. So then they had leeway on it. But Serling, you know, the classic show that, you know, we all, well, most of us love, I know you must because you're a sci-fi guy, The Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah, watched it all the time.
Serling realized that he wanted to talk about the great liberal issues of the day, but he kept being censored, like so many directors that wound up saying to hell with this and going off into film. And his way around it was to put the settings in these bizarre, otherworldly kinds of scenes where he could then put his message across, and the censors would be kind of looking at it like, well, I guess that's all right, because it takes place on Mars.
Yeah, I don't really understand that, but I'll let it go.
Right.
Yeah.
So he was able to do what he wanted to do by getting around them, which is really a terrible thing to think about.
Well, but there's a long tradition in science fiction of authors and later, you know, creators of television shows and movies of using science fiction to communicate messages that would be offensive or outrageous or censored if they had been communicated in a straightforward fashion. I know that you're planning to do some work on H.G. Wells and Orson Welles. And H.G. Wells did this with the Time Machine, commenting on ongoing debates about creationism versus evolutionary teachings and Darwin, that he was able to kind of look at the world of the future, uh-huh, and kind of imagine these segregated races of the Morlocks and the Eloi, and as a result, kind of comment that, you know, if we're not aware of what's going on here in our present society, that this is what we will evolve into. So it's kind of an interesting commentary, but it takes it both outside of the traditional debate about evolutionary teaching and Darwin, right, but also enables him to make a commentary in a way that's much more embraced than would be any kind of nonfiction tract that H.G. Wells could write, though he wrote many of those as well.
We like to think in this country that we're so free to express ourselves any way we like, but I think that the reality is, and we're part of this here at KDVS, is that the media and television and radio are owned by several, at this point probably a handful of very large corporations who aren't necessarily interested in making sure that, you know, all sides of a story get put forward.
Oh, yeah, one example of that, a couple of weeks ago there were talks between ABC and AOL, Time Warner, CNN, of like bringing ABC and CNN together, and so that they wouldn't have to duplicate so many of their efforts. So if we think about it, you know, if more people in fact do get the news from ABC News, yeah, than from any other source, mm-hmm, and if everyone who subscribes to cable has CNN on all the time, then just think about all the voices that will not be heard because just a few companies, you know, AOL, Disney, GE, that they really own the message as well as the medium now. And therefore, many of us who are looking for alternative viewpoints, you know, we don't necessarily have the Rod Serling or even the Milton Berle to turn to.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, but I hear people talk about, you know, the liberal media all the time. How can you trust the liberal media? My comment to that is that, you know, the liberal media, that's like the Loch Ness Monster. I've heard about it, but I've never really seen it. You know, I'm not sure it's really out there. I mean, before both of our shows, there's Free Speech Radio, and they're very left of center. I don't certainly always agree with some of the things that they're saying, viewpoints, but sometimes I do agree with what they're saying, and I think it's good to hear an alternate viewpoint.
It is, and you get and you get a real slant on, say, Fox News all the time, where it seems like it's not necessarily news, it's just an ongoing argument that they're trying to convince me of something. And I think that Free Speech Radio, you know, does that to a certain extent from obviously another perspective. But when you listen to Free Speech Radio, it engages with you because it makes you want to say, you know, do I agree with that?
Yes.
Is that a perspective that I agree with? Or, you know, isn't that thought provoking? And a lot of the pablum that you get from ABC or CNN, it doesn't really provoke thought. It really appeals to only the lowest common denominator, and therefore makes thinking people feel like there's got to be another source for news about the world.
Well, I think in our own small way, you and I are doing what we can to further that.
Absolutely. I think that Davis is a place that's open to alternative viewpoints. And I think that KDVS, in part because we are not beholden to corporate sponsors, and because it's a station that's run by students, independent-minded students who love not only alternative music, but alternative reflections on the news, really give us all an opportunity to imagine our world in ways that we wouldn't encounter on the four big networks.
Well, I think that, NBC is owned by General Electric. CBS is what used to be Westinghouse. Now it's Viacom. ABC is owned by, you know, Disney. And Fox is owned by the Republican Party.
I think you're right.
Ostensibly owned by Rupert Murdoch, but seems to be 24/7 GOP, the GOP slant on the world.
Or at least he loans it out to the Republican Party on weekends. Yeah.
Well, I think we would lament the fact that television is so often fallen short of what it could be. I can't even imagine watching television for these shows, Friends, Frasier. I mean, I don't know. Even as an entertainment medium, I think it's just so far from what it could be.
Oh, absolutely. And all of us own VCRs now. Many of us own DVD players. There's so much to choose from that we don't really have to settle for the junk that we get on television. You know, as Beaver says, it's the same old junk, and I don't think that we need any more of it. We've got great movies, and also increasingly with, I had on my show a couple months ago now, Marty Greenwald, who's the CEO of Image Entertainment. And one thing that he does with his business is he looks into niche publishing of DVDs that wouldn't appeal to huge audiences, because again, the corporate media, they've bought out, you know, they also own the movie companies.
Yes,
you know,
show is a good show.
And so as a result, you know, if you want to see a DVD on poetry,
yeah,
or on art appreciation, or on the sort of things that you might normally come across on PBS, if you want to own it on DVD, you could go to Image Entertainment. So we have lots of options as consumers of news, and we don't necessarily have to settle for what's on the big networks.
Indeed we don't. Well, Dr. Andy, it's been a good segment once again. Thank you for returning to our program.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate the invitation.
All right. You are listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM.